Well, thank you, Dr. Baker. It's a pleasure to be here. And I'm going to talk about what the knowledge that we've obtained about the circuits affecting underlie the pathophysiology of mood disorders and how we're learning from those circuits to generate new treatments for depression. And I'll specifically talk about pharmaceutical treatments, but I'll also allude to the neurosurgical treatments and neurostimulation treatments that Dr. Lozano will speak about subsequently. As Dr. Baker mentioned, I'm a full-time employee of Janssen, which is Janssen Research and Development, part of Johnson & Johnson. And I'll mention during the course of my talk one compound that's related to a compound that we're working on. So I'll mention ketamine for use in treatment-resistant depression. And we're actually developing the S-enantiomer of ketamine, so it's chemically related for treatment-resistant depression. One of the things that that we've learned from brain mapping studies that have relied either on imaging or more basic techniques such as those that were shown earlier by the previous speakers or lesion analysis is we've learned a lot about the kinds of functional domains that are mediated by different parts of the brain. And when patients have mood disorders, and I'll specifically talk about major depressive disorder, major depression, they have several domains of affected over a long, prolonged period of time. So it's not just emotion, it's in several other manifestations within the brain. And so I'll talk especially about the ventral part of the prefrontal cortex that is known now to be playing major roles in the regulation of emotion, both from the standpoint of regulating how the brain processes emotional stimuli, how it regulates our expression or behavior associated with emotion, and how it regulates our feeling of emotion or experience. We also learned about structures that participate with the prefrontal cortex to organize and express depression. These include areas like the ventral striatum or accumbens area that is important in depression and in drug abuse behavior because it underlies pleasure, motivation, anxiety, domains that are all affected in mood disorders. I'll talk about the amygdala, which is in along with the hippocampus are both deep in the temporal lobe. The amygdala plays an important role in anxiety, fear, sadness, but also reward learning. And the hippocampus, which plays a role more generally in memory, but including it plays an important role at setting context with how the brain essentially evaluates stimuli for positive or negative valence. And then there are other regions like the hypothalamus that get involved in the regulating the hormones involved in stress, sleep, appetite, energy, all domains affected in mood disorders. And the brainstem areas that are involved in arousal, sleep-wake cycles, aversion, reward, all of these reflect the behavioral domains that are affected in mood disorders. The advent of brain imaging technologies allowed us to look at all of these structures functioning in concert with each other. And so this is just a simpler type of brain imaging called PET imaging, where we measured glucose metabolism or blood flow as reflections of where the energy was being shifted differently in depression. Dr. Hill mentioned, the brain highly conserves its energy resources. And so what this technology shows us is where it's diverting those resources in depression. And so you see these ventral prefrontal cortex regions being overactive with the amygdala and the medial thalamus. And then this is also part of the ventral medial prefrontal cortex, an area that both Dr. Lozano and I will discuss called the subgenual anterior cingulate, where metabolism is actually more complex, and I'll come back to that later. We talk about circuits in the brain because if you think about the synapses, the axons, dendrites that you were just looking at within the cortex, they will have preferences about where they'll send outgoing axons and where they're receiving incoming axons. And so the specific regions that I'll talk about, and this is a cross-section of the amygdala, which is a cluster of nuclei that get involved involved in driving the hypothalamus and other brainstem structures to organize the autonomic, behavioral, and endocrine aspects of emotional behavior. And this structure is, as I mentioned, heavily regulated by the ventral part of the prefrontal cortex, a network that regulates the emotional behavior. And then they also send projections to the medial thalamus to form what we've called the limbic thalamocortical circuit. This circuit is supplemented by another side loop that includes projections involving the ventral striatum, onto the ventral pallidum, and so there's also a circuit through that region that's implicated in depression. This is relevant because where you see the most extensive projections of the amygdala are shaded here in black, and so that it'll implicate the anterior cingulate region that Dr. Lozano and I will talk about, especially, but also areas of the temporal lobe, the rostral temporal lobe, where you get the most abundant projections. We think, explains why in people who have either familial depression that runs in families, or if they have chronic or highly recurrent depression, they'll actually lose gray matter volume in these regions, these projections of the amygdala. So this is now just a different section in a human superimposed over a human MRI, where we can see gray matter reductions in the medial, this ventral medial prefrontal cortex that I referred to as subgenual, and also these rostral anterior temporal regions where you had the predominant amygdala projections. And this is viewing that network now as a circuit diagram, and so this is representing amygdala hippocampus and its projections onto the thalamus and shared with this medial prefrontal cortex. And then this side loop through the striatum, pallidum, and back is also represented here. It's noteworthy because what Dr. Lozano will talk about is that how you can use deep brain stimulation in a limb of this. And prior to what Dr. Lozano, a neurosurgeon, was doing, there were other neurosurgeons that were actually making lesions in the same region. And so it's in advance what Dr. Lozano is doing now to get the same benefit using deep brain stimulation instead of lesions. But there are other limbs within this circuit where some other researchers are also now showing that historically surgeries helped treatment-resistant depression, and where deep brain stimulation techniques may also be of benefit. Both of us will talk about this area. I'll refer to it as a subgenual prefrontal cortex because it's beneath the genu or knee of the corpus callosum. Dr. Lozano may refer to it as the subcallosal anterior cingulate because it's beneath the anterior the corpus callosum. But we're both talking about the same structure. And this is an area where you find a complex relationship with energy utilization, in this case glucose metabolism. You have a reduction in glucose metabolism in depression in familial cases overall, but within that it's modulated, so it's actually elevated relative to the same state in non-depressed patients. So under treatment, you actually see a fall further. And that's because this area is one of those regions where you've lost a substantial amount of cortex in familial cases with either unipolar or bipolar depression. This reduction in cortex is essentially thought to be caused by a reduction in the dendrites in the moss-like layer called the neuropil that Dr. Hill was referring to that forms the networks. 90% of the volume is actually taken up by those dendritic and axonal processes that he was referring to. And in postmortem studies, that's actually what's reduced, along with the difference in synapses, which Dr. Hill also talked about. Those are both reduced in this region in patients with depression. Now, this does translate into a reduction in activity. These are data from Eric Nessler's lab looking at the same region in patients who had unipolar bipolar disorder and then died by suicide. You see both in medicated and unmedicated patients, they've got a reduction in immediate early gene expression, so that the function of the area is diminished. Eric has worked with experimental animal paradigm that recapitulates this process called a social defeat stress model, in which he takes animals that some of which develop a depression-like phenotype after repeated social stress and some which do not, and then he compares the two. And the animals that develop the depression-like behavior following this stress will actually show this very same reduction in immediate early gene expression compared to the animals who are resilient and don't develop this depression-like behavior. He also showed that you could use a new technique, which is right now is only being used in experimental animals, but involves optogenetics, where he stimulates the same region. And in this case, channel rhodopsin is what he uses to stimulate the region. So by using light, then, in the presence of this channel rhodopsin, you can stimulate the neurons to activity. And what he's able to show, then, is that M. Sherry is a control substance, so you don't get the stimulation going on. But he's able to show that by stimulating in this region, he's able to reverse the depression-like behaviors measured in this case either by the social interaction that these animals will show with other animals or by their preference for sucrose, a sweet substance. And so analogous to what Dr. Lozano is doing in stimulating this region to improve depression, Dr. Nessler has been able to do this in these rodent models using optogenetic stimulation. Now, you can also do this, it appears, with pharmacological substances. And so ketamine is an NMDA receptor antagonist that's been historically used as an anesthetic drug, and then it was discovered that sub-anesthetic doses will induce antidepressant effects in people who've been treatment-resistant to conventional therapies. This is Ron Duman's work, and it's a different type of animal model. In this case, it's a chronic unpredictable stress, or CUS. And in this case, he's able to show that after a few weeks of chronic unpredictable stress, rodents will actually lose these dendrites, and so the spine density is decreasing. So it's recapitulating this volume loss and tissue loss that you see in patients with depression. 24 hours after one dose of ketamine will restore the spine density back to normal. Here he's showing that those spines are actually functional. During chronic unpredictable stress, the response in the medial prefrontal cortex, in a region that's analogous to the subgenual region that I'll continue to talk about, you see in the stressed model animals, they lose the responsivity to serotonin and orexin, which is a hypocretin. But this is actually restored 24 hours after one dose of ketamine. So these new synapses being formed following ketamine are actually functional. The clinical data has continued to be compelling. This is from a meta-analysis of treatment-resistant depressant patients from academic studies in which you see a significant antidepressant effect relative to placebo in each of these studies. And here the meta-analysis shows an odds ratio of nearly 10 for having an antidepressant effect. This is measured after one day post ketamine, and in contrast, these are data after 1 week, and so you do start to lose the effect, and some patients will lose it within as little as 3 or 4 days. And so, several groups have now shown that you can repeat these administrations of ketamine at twice a week, or subsequently even at longer intervals, and maintain the antidepressant benefit. But one of the points is is that these are all, this maintenance of a single dose is giving you an antidepressant effect that extends well beyond the pharmacological action. The half-life of this drug is only 2 hours. And so we think that the explanation for this persistent, more prolonged effect in humans is essentially explained by the animal studies, which show that you're getting these changes in synaptic plasticity. So the working model then has been, and this is a model of a glutamate synapse, which Dr. Friend also showed in more detail. There's evidence now that these repeated stress models, and perhaps they're doing this by increasing glucocorticoids, like in our case it would be cortisol, or cytokines, which are hormones of the immune system, and then these stressors also reduce neurotrophic factors like brain-derived neurotrophic factor, and that's what is thought to lead to the synaptic loss and atrophy that's found in these depression models in rodents, but also in depressed humans studied postmortem. And then the ketamine is, as an NMDA receptor antagonist, actually gives you a brief surge in glutamate that's transient, and that then triggers a LTP or long-term potentiation-like effect, where you get this synaptogenesis, the formation of new synapses, and that's what we think ketamine is doing to improve the function. Now, why would it be beneficial to improve the function of that ventral anterior cingulate region? I'm just going to show some slides from the group that Dr. Lozano is working with. So here you see some of the loci from where electrodes are stimulating this is the area that we're referring to as subgenual anterior cingulate. And from some of these electrodes, they actually obtained measurements of electrical activity in humans with depression as they were looking at emotional stimuli. And they were able to show that these neurons in this area were emotion specific in terms of what kind of characteristics they responded to of picture stimuli. And in these depressed patients, and they didn't have a control group that was had the deep brain stimulation. So in the depressed patients, this region was predominantly responding to negative stimuli, especially sad. We and others have used functional MRI to map the responses to sad and happy stimuli in patients with depression. And one of the things that we found is that there's a bias toward negative in depressed patients that then reverses back to positive with treatment. Although it's not shown on this slide, the response pattern that the treated patients are showing is actually the same as normal controls or healthy controls show, who are not depressed. So what you see then is that in the pretreated baseline, or the blue bars, these neurons are responding preferentially to the sad, and then after treatment, they'll respond preferentially to the happy. So here you see the response is broken down to sad stimuli versus to happy stimuli. And so you get a reversal of this phenomenon. Interestingly, these stimuli are all shown below the level of conscious awareness using a backward masking technique. The change that you get with SSRI, this is using the SSRI sertraline, an antidepressant drug that's conventional, is correlated with how much the improvement is in depression. And also the baseline activity in this region is predictive of response to a variety of antidepressants, including ketamine. And this, as I mentioned, is one of those regions that has extensive connections to amygdala and hippocampus. I think in the interest of time, I'm going to skip this and just go to the last slide. To point that we're taking illnesses that right now we only define as behaviors, symptoms and behaviors right now in psychiatry, but we're learning about, through brain imaging and other techniques, we're learning about the systems that are affected in these techniques and are able to target some of those, including with agents that would modulate glucocorticoid function, as I mentioned, but also that would modulate endocannabinoid function, as Dr. Friend's said, to modulate the abnormal activity in these regions. We're learning specifically about some of the cellular abnormalities that are contributing to these enhancements of glutamate transport in these regions. For example, glutamate transport on glia are consistently abnormal, and endocannabinoids are consistently reduced in studies of depression. And we're learning about how we can modulate some of these signaling molecules that we think are contributing to the volume loss. We've also started to learn from the genetic abnormalities in familial cases that present targets are involved in the same system through which we can modulate the pathophysiology of depression. So with that, let me stop and turn it over to Dr. Lozano.